Chapter 3. At dawn, following her regular devotions, Spinoza resumed her research. Her cell had been piled with books for some days, and more were scheduled to arrive soon. They formed mouldering stacks on the metal floor, all dusty, flaking spines, and in the case of the most proscribed, coils of rusting chains. The light from the window was as grey and weak as ever, and so candles burned, casting a wavering yellow blush over the vellum. Spinoza had always been a diligent student, and knew more of the technicalities of the Lex Imperialis than most of her peers, but Terra, needless to say, had its peculiarities. The Lex, already complex beyond mortal calculation, was further complicated here by ancient treaties and pacts, some predating the Imperium itself, all relating to the institutions that only existed here. The task of a judge was hard enough in any context. On the throne world, where billions of illiterates live desperate lives crammed up against one another in the dark, occupying chambers and roles that had been old even before the myth age of the great heresy, it was nigh impossible. Lermontov, the heretic, had told her exactly how it was.
"The people here have precisely three fears: the monsters, each other, and you."
She snapped closed the tome in front of her. She admonished herself. Lermontov was dead now, and his execution had been just. She should not be recalling anything he had told her, not even in scraps of unbidden memory. Spinoza pushed herself back from her desk and rubbed her eyes. She got up and paced around her cell. Argent was under wraps, a dormant presence in the shadows, something to be pushed away, too, lest it prove another distraction. She needed to begin her investigations soon, following Kral's direction, and she was not making good progress with her preparations. The cause, she knew, lay within. Too many doubts refused to be quashed through the usual methods. If she were to return to full operational effectiveness, there was little point hammering away at the same worn-out seams. She needed a change. She pulled her cloak across her shoulders and activated the door release. The candles fluttered as she swept out into the corridor beyond. After that, she trod a practiced route through Corvain's convoluted inner pathways. Menials, more of them than usual it seemed, bowed and scurried around her. Many were carrying bundles of sensitive parchments, and some were escorted by stormtroopers from the house detachment. Rivas was working hard, further ramping up security in a citadel where it had already been ratchet tight. The work created an atmosphere of more than usual tension, one that made the thrall classes nervy. She descended rapidly, finding her way, as she had done before, to Yulia Hook's little realm. The place was just as she remembered it from the last time, a circular well lined with parchment and synth-leather bookspines, its symmetry broken by the scampering servitor creatures in their retrieval baskets. More of them were working this time, hauling on the chains with their metal-clamped fingertips and throwing books jerkily into their shoulder-strapped hoppers. She wondered where Hook kept them when they were not on duty. The archivist herself was facing away from her as she entered, observing the clattering progress of her creatures, and only turned as Spinoza came up close. For a moment, her crabbed face looked panicked, and then it relaxed into a lopsided grin.
"Ah, you!"
Hook said, making the heavy cables running from her hunched back wobble as she turned.
"The Scholar girl, what are you down here for?"
Spinoza was not, by any rational measure, a girl. Before coming to Corvain, she might have made something of the insult, but Hook was just one of the eccentrics Kral seemed happy to cultivate, and who had become such a wretch in his service that it seemed pointless to add to her misery.
"I require information on the Arbites Sector Command," she said. "I thought that..."
"I might be able to help,"
Hook snorted a dry laugh.
"No, not at all. See this? This is what he makes me do for him now."
She gestured with ironwork fingers to her vaulting gangs of servitors.
"He wants every scrap of every little thing. Xenos? Yes. The Senatorum? Yes. Old Rassilo? We don't have much on her, but yes, yes, yes."
She winked at Spinoza with her one good eye.
"I don't like to refuse him. But you, no capacity. Come back later."
Spinoza stared at her. The Keeper of Records seemed more shambolic than ever, as if the augmetics that held her together were slowly coming apart. The pulses running down her extensive cabling were travelling faster than they had done before, a flickering dance of rapid synapse conveyance.
"It will have to wait for some time, then," Spinoza said curtly. "I will be on mission again before this day closes. Many thanks, though, for your help."
Hook sidled up to her.
"Don't be like that."
Her voice could switch to a wheedle instantaneously.
"We're all working hard. What did you find out there? You can tell me."
"You know I can't."
"I'll put it together sooner or later," she grinned. "I can work it out from what you file, or don't, given time."
The smile flickered out again.
"But you didn't come down here for papers. You have plenty of those."
That was true.
"You wanted to talk to me before," Spinoza said.
"About Crowl, of course. But you know all about him now, don't you?"
"Tell me about yourself, then."
Hook recoiled. She smiled again, though weakly.
"Not sure why you'd want to know, and we're busy."
"I do not believe you commenced your service in these archives."
"No, no, of course not."
Hook's eyepiece whirred, and she pulled at her robes absently.
"Savant. He didn't have a retinue. You hear that all the time. But he didn't, except he needed a savant, and I was training then, and I liked him, and he liked me. I was good, very good."
She winced.
"But it is hard. Your mind, it changes. Some do not cope. They do not remember. I began to forget. A savant never forgets. I made a mistake. A bad one."
Hook began to look anguished again.
"Then they were coming for me. It would have been a poor death. I couldn't have argued with it. It would have been easier for him to stand aside and let them take me."
She shook her head.
"He didn't. He buried me down here instead. I can still be of service, see?"
The grin returned.
"I paid him back, I think. Over the years, I got good at this. My mind, never the same. But I'm still good, very good."
"It is a dangerous thing," said Spinoza, "to interfere with just sanction."
"And who says it was just?"
Hook chuckled.
"Maybe it was, but maybe it wasn't. You'll learn the difference soon enough."
"I already know it."
"Of course you do."
Hook limped around her, her tattered skirts dragging on the stone floor.
"You think he's dangerous. You think he's a whisper away from going rogue. Don't deny it."
Spinoza smiled to herself.
"We have our disagreements," she said. "I admire the way he allows me to express them."
"Then don't be a fool."
Hook sidled up closer, and unpleasant aromas wafted up from under the cloak.
"There's no more loyal servant to the throne."
"Though he conceals it well."
"You know his condition. It makes him care less about what he says."
"Words matter."
"Do they?" "Not really. Not most of the time."
They looked at one another for a little while. Spinoza saw the ruin on Hook's features, the slide into half-maintained dereliction. Everything here was falling into ruin, and no one ever queried it. She wondered if Hook saw the same in her. She pulled away.
"I will return, when I can," she said. "Then I will require my information."
Hook shuffled off, looking uncertain, as if she couldn't remember what she'd just said, or why she had said it.
"Of course,"
she mumbled.
"But this place is disordered,"
Spinoza added, turning on her heel.
"You are a savant. You should fix it."
Hook watched her go.
"Some things can't be fixed," she mumbled.
"Everything can be remade," Spinoza said, reaching the doors. "That is the lesson he teaches us every day."
The locks cycled.
"Not here,"
said Hook, as Spinoza crossed the threshold. She turned back to her servitors and her chrono-racks.
This is terror.
It was the first time Crowell had left Corvain since sustaining his injuries. He took a ground car with a kneeler in the cab, feeling somehow that staying close to the earth might help him adjust, and in any case the distance to travel was small. They pulled out of the vehicle depot in a cough of smoke, then growled up to the main transitway. Crowell sat back, letting the lights from the city filter through the armour grill viewport, and watched. For most of human history, orientation on this world had been virtually two-dimensional. There was the ground and the sky, and the entirety of the living occupied a narrow strip between them. By the 41st millennium, that distinction had all but disappeared, to the extent that it was very uncertain where the ground on Terra actually was. The foundations of the great hive spires delved far below the nominal surface crust. Hidden catacombs and pits plunged down further still, honeycombing the world's upper mantle in a deepening procession of worm-eaten galleries. In the filmy air above it all, the jutting hive spires merged and branched in dizzying, almost organic thickets, joined and trussed by spans and viaducts and Gothic arches, such that no structure ever really stood independently of any other, and all was lost in a grime-stained haze of fumes and vented condensation. Transitways perched high up and jutted down low, sweeping round the bowls of the spires before toppling back into the lamp-lit depths, then branching, then rejoining, then coalescing into the vast, echoing transportation nexuses before more routes sprouted and divided away again. Old ordinances governed their use, rigorously categorizing the cracked rockcrete avenues by purpose and status. The majority, the via exclusiva, were reserved for security personnel, leaving the greater bulk of the population to travel on the wider but more heavily congested via ordinaria, jostling and clawing past one another to get to wherever they needed to be. A select subset, the via prohibita, was kept clear for the very highest echelons of the imperial hierarchy, the governing classes, senior enforcers of the Adeptus Arbites, agents of the Inquisition. These narrow conduits shot precariously above the rest, tracing efficient routes between the major administrative centres, though it was rarely possible to complete an entire journey without having to duck down onto less exalted transitways. For the time being, though, the ground car travelled at one remove from the great press of humanity, a little higher up, a little further away. Crowell watched as the dim walls of the great spires passed by, flickering through the narrow slats of the grill, a steady march of grey-black terraces and buttresses. The fervour of Sanguinala was a distant memory now, lost in the resumption of work details and shift patterns. Everywhere he looked, he saw labour gang transports grinding their way to their silos, or ecclesiarchy floats pushing their way through the crowds, blaring out echoing hymn loops, or supply haulers lumbering smokily towards the distribution centres. The percentage of Terra's inhabitants who ever left the interior of their home spire was small, but even so, every sliver of available space was still taken up, wreathed in a boil of engine exhaust that curled up through the tangle of support columns and flying buttresses. Anila did not hurry, keeping the ground car's ride smooth through the sparser traffic of the exclusive zones.
"Any trouble contacting him?"
Crowell asked, tiring of the monotonous view.
"Not at all. I got the impression the appointment was welcome."
They started to climb, following a snaking route that twisted through the very heart of a tower cluster. Swarms of atmospheric craft hovered around them, both above and below, gliding like dirty fish through the sedimentary layers of Terra-choked airways. A big dirigible, all flabby air sacs and lazily spinning turbines, wallowed under the archway below, trailing long metallic sensor fronds. Its swaying skirts bore the imagery of a sector-level ministorum convent, but Crowell guessed it was probably a surveillance unit from one of the hundreds of scrutiny details that prowled every inch of the world city's airways. You got to recognise the signs after a while. Soon another spire was looming, a horn-shaped mass of dark iron crowned with battered stone angels. Its flanks were speckled with flecks of neon yellow, and its entire northern shoulder seemed to be somewhat slumped, as if dozens of hab levels had subsided before reaching a kind of equilibrium, a frozen landslide of permacrete and twisted steel. The groundcar slipped from the privileged zone and onto one of several dozen access routes. The space around them filled with bulkier vehicles, though the other drivers soon recognised the matte black profile of an Inquisition transport and did their best to get out of the way. Vehicles shunted into one another or dragged themselves along the perimeter barriers just to clear a path, through which Anila coolly guided them. In time, they reached a yawning entrance chamber, its arched ceiling lost in shadows, its walls studded with smog-caked angelic figures. Ignoring the security teams vetting incoming traffic, they peeled off up a steep ramp, plunging into the spire's innards, then switched back through steeply climbing roadways. The space around them shrunk until they were almost grazing the edges of the tunnels, and the murky roof got within a metre of the ground car's comms aerials. Eventually, Anila pulled up before a pair of bronze gates and got out of the cab. Crowell, still seated, peered out at twin braziers burning in the gloom and saw armoured guardians at station on either side of a heavy blast door. He let his eyes run over the slabbed armour panels above and spied two needle gun notches and the glint of a sensor bead. No doubt there were other devices, better hidden further in. "Not very welcoming," he observed as Anila got out, opened the doors and stood to attention. "Not at all," she agreed. "Wait here until I return, please." "By your will." Crowell walked on alone, passing through the gates and limping up chipped stone stairs to the doors beyond. The guardians, who looked much as Revis's soldiers did, saluted as they activated the unlock pistons. He went inside. The change was instant. The grimy exterior, lost down the dead end of a hive spire's buried transit arteries, hid an interior of rare opulence. Crowell's boots sunk into a deep pile rug. The walls were marble, and high-polished mirrors reflected the warm light of a dozen gold-lined suspensers. Every surface was heaped with artifacts and objects of bewildering variety. A long skull preserved in a glass case, a diamond-tipped sabre, a porcelain vase decorated with strange hieroglyphs. Music was playing somewhere, though of a type he couldn't place. It was hard to listen to if you concentrated on it. He pressed on, walking down a long hall hung with paintings, and eventually reached a circular reception chamber. The clutter grew ever more pronounced and strange. Much of the furniture was very fine indeed, but every tabletop and chair seat was stuffed with ephemera. Smells, most of them foreign and difficult to identify, tumbled out of the perforated lips of sensors. It began to feel a little confined, a little oppressive. The circular chamber had three doors leading from it, only one of which stood open. Crowell passed through and found himself in a high-ceilinged room of domestic proportions. The walls were lined with books, most very old, and all kept locked behind crystal security screens. More esoterica lay in heaps, antique weapons, precious stones sitting on velvet pads, slow-cycling hollow images imprisoned behind ornate glasswork frames. "Good morning to you, Erasmus," came a soft voice from an armchair on the far side of the chamber. The speaker was an old man, slim, with fine wrinkled skin and a balding pate. He wore thick burgundy robes that hung heavily over slender wrists and thick spectacles with silver frames. He looked frail and neat and faintly incongruous, like a tall bird wrapped in a carpet. Crowell picked his way through the clutter until he reached a second armchair. He removed a few items from the seat, placing them on the nearest teetering pile, and sat down. "Sleck," Crowell said. "You've had a clear out since I was last here." The light filtering through the windows behind his host was clear and warm. It appeared as if the space beyond was open to the sky, and the silhouettes of hothouse plants trembled behind the glass. Of course, it wasn't the real sky. They were buried too deep for that, and in any case, Terra's sky was never clear and warm.
"You do not look well, my friend," Sleck nor Jarrod said. "Will you have a cordial?"
Jarrod's cordials were interesting things. As a long-serving member of the Ordo Xenos, he had things in his caches that were almost certainly illegal, not that anyone would have dared to rummage through them.
"Something restorative," Crowell said.
A moment later, a slender figure weaved their way through the tottering heaps of taxidermy and real bronze figurines. He might have been a boy. She might have been a girl. It was impossible to tell. They were slim, almost impossibly so, and dressed in a clinging shift of gauzy silver. Something about their movements was hard to get used to, the poise, perhaps, or the silent way they trod through the mess. They carried a silver tray with two goblets, each containing a turquoise liquid that smelled of rose petals. As soon as they had delivered them, they slipped away again.
"This is very expensive," Jared said, raising his goblet.
"Everything you own is very expensive," said Kral, taking a sip. It was good, too, though the impressions it gave were as elusive as everything else in this place.
Alien. They talked companionably enough. Jared asked after Revis. Kral asked after Ohana Vroon, Jared's captain of stormtroopers. They discussed the politics of the Inquisition on Terra, the performance of Cleopatra Arx in the High Council, the prospect of another interminable reorganization. Kral admired Jared's latest items. Jared admired, for the umpteenth time, Kral's lunar-forged sidearm.
"But you did not come here for cordial and conversation," Jared said eventually.
"I should have done," said Kral. "Both are excellent."
"You have a question?"
"I have a story."
"Very good. I like stories."
Jared settled back in his chair, letting his hands cross on his lap. His inquisitorial rosette, an insectoid of some kind, locked in amber, nestled within the folds of his robe.
"I became aware of a foolish plan," said Kral. "It was to bring a Xenos creature alive to a hive world." "Very foolish. What kind of Xenos creature?"
"A painbringer. I can describe it. You will be able to give me the precise term." He listed the way the creature had looked, its skeletal frame, its shifting robes, its bone-white skin stretched tight over prominent bones, the metalwork pinned through its flesh, its eyes, its black, black eyes.
"You are describing a homunculus." "Throne. Who told you of this plan?"
"A friend."
"And for what purpose was one of them brought to a hive world?"
"I was never sure. But it matters not. The point is this. Once imported, it did not do as intended. It pursued its own course, one that to my mind was almost mad, suicidal, and so it proved. My friend tells me the creature is dead now."
"Throne be praised."
"So I'm left with a puzzle," said Kral. "The expense and effort required to bring it to that world were huge. They must have had expectations that it could do something for them. And yet it did not."
"Why?"
"I do not know. I wondered if you might." Jared frowned.
"It is dangerous to look for reason in what such creatures do. Very dangerous."
Then he smiled brightly.
"But also intriguing. What do you understand of the Dark Elder?"
"Very little."
"Keep it that way. They are beyond abhorrent."
Jared shook his head.
"Even I do not know enough. No one in the Ordo knows everything, for they are almost impossible to capture. I have never met one in the flesh. Few people have. So your friend was fortunate, or perhaps unfortunate, to have done so. But let me tell you what is known."
He reached up to his rosette and began to toy with it absently.
"They are called painbringers for a reason. They live for it. It is not an affectation for them. It is life itself. We do not know precisely why, but there are accounts of them being imprisoned and kept away from any possible prey, and after a time spent thus, even when given solid food and water and kept in comfort, they wither. They begin to rave, then to decay. Given long enough, they will expire. I've seen the footage of this, and it is unpleasant. They are terrified at the end, clawing the metal bars, pleading. And so it has been postulated that the infliction of agony is in some way essential to their survival. If they are given subject to desecrate, then they can survive under such conditions indefinitely."
"How was that supposition tested?"
Do not ask.
Jared let his rosette fall and reached for his goblet.
Let us return to your friend. Suppose someone were foolish enough to bring a homunculus to a hive world. It would be the very opposite of the confinement I have described. The creature would be surrounded by billions of souls, all of them vulnerable, all of them alluring. You must understand that these creatures experience sensation far more acutely than we do. Their appetites dominate them, if allowed to. For this precise sect of the species, appetite is all that remains. It was placed in an environment of overwhelming, intoxicating abundance. I suspect that your judgment was right, Erasmus. I suspect it went mad. If it had some purpose in the beginning, then that must have been quickly forgotten.
Kral rested his chin on his interlocked fingers.
Then it would be folly for those who arrange this to try the same thing again. It was folly the first time.
And what would it do to those who came into contact with it?
Jarrod shrugged. They would die, painfully.
But if they survived? He looked at Kral carefully.
What do you mean?
If a human were exposed to such a creature, even for a short time, and somehow survived. Kral held Jarrod's gaze.
What effects might that have?
For a moment, Jarrod did not reply.
It would depend on the context, he said eventually. Any Xenos is to be avoided. Their vices are legion. In this case, I've been told their speech is treacherous. I have been told their aroma is uniquely repulsive, no doubt partly due to their vile practices. But you will know all this.
He reached for his drink.
I did speak to the master of the prisons where the experiments I mentioned were carried out. He had trouble sleeping, perhaps not surprising. He also told me there were some things he could never get out of his head. He told me that he felt sometimes as if the creature had taken up residence there, even after its documented and witnessed death, and was making him think strange things. He feared that his judgment was becoming tainted.
How did you respond to that?
How anyone would have done. I reported him to his superiors. His replacement was given more strenuous psycho-conditioning.
I see.
Is that the answer you were hoping for?
It is all useful. I'm still trying to make sense of the story.
A true story, is it? I struggle to believe it.
Kral ran his gaze across the objects around him. Many were of human origin. Many were not. One long tusk had been mounted over the mantelpiece, its notched length studded with bullet holes. Polished gems set in rune-carved lozenges hung on either side, glimmering faintly, as if animated by an internal light.
"Does it not make you sick at heart to be surrounded by such grotesque things?" Kral asked. "No more so than the witches and fools you treat with, I expect. Your hatred for the alien, given all other possible targets for righteous anger, has always intrigued me."
"They are the ordained foe of humanity," Jarrod laughed.
"So the cult teaches. I thought you only paid attention to the parts of that you liked."
Kral sighed.
"A heretic was a man once, or a woman once, or a child. They were gifted something precious, but chose to cast it aside. That is a tragedy, but an understandable one, for weakness is the condition of the masses. These things, though, they are predators, they are beasts. There is no morality in them, no judgment or law. They say much the same about us. A dangerous equivalence. If I were cut from a different cloth..." "Did you discover what you wished to?"
Kral smiled faintly and looked down at his clasped hands.
"It was helpful. My thanks." "The story was intriguing, though. I may have to investigate it further.
I would not recommend that. These things happen far away.
Oh.
Kral stood.
Thanks for the drink.
Any time. It looks like you could use another one.
I could. What was in it?
Grotesque things.
Kral picked a path through Jarrod's collections as he made his way out. Goodbye, Sleck. Take care of yourself.
You too, Kral.